Okay, this is the hour we will take your phone calls with the astrophysicist, biologist, Stephen Dick. So you get ready to make the call, and we'll get right to you on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Stephen Dick with us, and of course, we'll take your phone calls as well. You know, we were talking earlier about science fiction, Stephen, and how it kind of meshes with some of this. Some of those great minds of those science fiction writers, how did they know about future technologies? I mean, they were gifted people.
Well, I think they had a wide open mind, and that's one thing you need for science fiction, whether it's talking about technologies or extraterrestrials. You try and think beyond the everyday existence that most people live and think what might happen in the future. People like Jules Verne, you know, amazing predictions that he made, and a lot of the other science fiction writers. And I just think it has to do with having an open mind and a vivid imagination, but also being grounded in science and trying to fathom what might happen in the future.
All right, let's go to the calls. They're lining up for you. Carl is in Milwaukee. You get us started. Hey, Carl, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I wanted to thank the Coast team for providing such an intelligent forum for us late-night owls. I truly appreciate it. And, George, I can remember in the olden days, calling in the line was always, always busy. And then one night I called, and it started to ring, and I thought, you dialed the wrong number. Almost hung up, and then the magic happened. It was, hi, you're on Coast to Coast, and it was that magical voice of Art Bell. Well, anyway, I would like to ask a question, please, Stephen.
Sure, absolutely.
I would imagine that in your work and your research that mathematics and your imagination or the ability to imagine is so important. And I'm wondering what comes first. Is it an idea or your imagination, then comes the mathematics? Or is it the math first and then comes your idea or the imagination?
For me, it's the idea that comes first. You know, you can work that out then in the mathematics. That raises an interesting question, though, which we haven't talked about in terms of is mathematics universal, or is we talked a little bit about is science universal. You know, it would seem obvious that mathematics is universal because one plus one is two wherever you are in the universe. But there are actually two sides to that. There are what are called the Platonists who think that numbers and mathematics are discovered, and then there are the other side called the Formalists who think that they're invented. So if mathematics is really invented, then would extraterrestrials have the same mathematics that we do? I think that's an interesting question. But in terms of what you just asked, for me, the idea comes first, and then you work it out in mathematics, although I think, you know, it could be the reverse for other people, including the mathematicians.
Stephen, is there a universal law out there with what could be ETs and Earthlings? Would there be something there that would be a common denominator?
Well, that's a great question. We're pretty sure that physics is universal ever since Newton in the 17th century. And, you know, as far as we can see, the outermost galaxies, things are working according to gravitational theory as we know it, for the most part. Although there are some anomalies still to be worked out, but biology we don't know. The question of universal biology, even if we discover a microbe, I think would help us answer that question. We really have only one example of biology on Earth because it's all DNA based. If we found life with an independent genesis on Mars or somewhere else, then we could begin to talk about a universal biology, what's common among different biologies on different planets. And so I think that would be one of the immediate payoffs, even of finding microbial life. So from the physical point of view, certainly seems like that's a universal law. From the biological point of view, that's what we're trying to show.
Let's go to Jeff in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Steve. I have three related questions.
Okay.
One, have you both seen the movie Interstellar? I'd like to get your comments on that. Two, Stephen, your comrade Mark Lupicella in the book Cosmos and Culture talked about cosmocultural evolution, and he says that cultural evolution could have unlimited potential as a force in the overall evolution of the universe. A cosmocultural principle might even go further and suggest that when culture arises in a universe, it will effectively consume that universe. Take on that, and how is your philosophy similar to the old Russian philosophy of cosmism, like in Kardashev and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky?
Well, I have seen Interstellar, and I actually liked it. I thought maybe it had a bit of a slow start, but of course, with Kip Thorne, one of the great black hole gravitational experts as an advisor, they could hardly go wrong.
Yeah.
And I thought it got much better at the end in talking about wormholes and black holes and five-dimensional tesseracts and things like that. So I thought Interstellar was a great movie. In terms of cosmos and culture, yes, that's a volume that Mark Lupicella and I did together in the NASA history series. I believe his main point in there was that somehow the cosmos, in addition to coming up with life and intelligence, also comes up with value. In other words, the ideas of morality and that sort of thing. And where does that come from? Somehow we bootstrap our way to morality, and that goes to the question of altruism and whether aliens are good or bad out there. Now, in terms of consuming the universe, I don't remember exactly what his point was there, but I think the idea in that whole volume that we did, which, by the way, you can just download from the NASA History Office website, and has a lot of forward-looking articles in, including the one mine on the post-biological universe. The whole point of that whole volume was to talk about evolution, whether it's in terms of life, intelligence, or culture. So I do recommend that. Cosmism, yes. I'm trying to remember exactly what cosmism entailed. It is a Russian thing going back to Tsiolkovsky, and it's a philosophy which had to do with the cosmos and morality and value and our role in it. But I don't remember exactly what the point of cosmism is, except that it was an early form of a philosophy that was very much tied to the cosmos.
What did you think of the movie Contact from years gone back with Jodie Foster?
I thought, I know more about Contact than I would want to, because I was involved with Contact to the extent that many people don't know this, but when Carl Sagan died in 1996, his estate was sued by Francis Ford Coppola for infringement of intellectual property rights, because Coppola had hired Sagan in the 1970s to do a documentary about Contact and extraterrestrial life, which Coppola never did. He was worked on the other things like Apocalypse Now and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So there was this lawsuit, and I was an expert witness on that, and so had to testify that the ideas in Contact, the novel and the movie, were indeed either in Sagan's own work prior to his being contracted by Coppola, or were in other people's writings before that time. So anyway, Contact, I think, was a great novel and a great movie, and the Carl Sagan papers were just opened a year ago now at the Library of Congress, and one of the great things about my year there was I was able to use those papers, very extensive papers, 1,700 boxes. Carl Sagan never threw anything away. So if you want to know how the alien was constructed in the novel Contact, you can look at some of the dozens of boxes that exist in the archives at the Library of Congress.
Love it. Dave is in Canada now. You're on Coast to Coast. David, go ahead.
Hi, George, and hi, Stephen. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Sure. Thank you, David.
Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge, and I've been thinking about that. So here it comes. Dark energy equals dark matter times the speed of light squared. Stephen, would you like to comment?
Dark energy equals dark matter times the speed of light squared.
Yes.
Hmm. E squared. Well, normally you hear E equals MC squared. So I'd have to think about, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I can't just, forget. What exactly
write,
mean?
Write those figures out.
And, go ahead.
Write them out on a blackboard like Einstein, huh?
I'm not sure what it would mean, though.
And see what happens. Yeah, David, what do you think it means?
You know what quantum tunneling is? Where an electron will go across an insulator? That's
okay.
Quantum tunneling. It'll appear on the other side. It doesn't actually go through it. It just appears on the other side of it. So every there's a lot of matter in the universe that's in a different vibrational state, many vibrational states. So the question of dark energy and dark matter can be solved through this equation.
Okay.
Well, that's an interesting imaginative idea. I can't comment on it on the spur of the moment, though.
You got to be a physicist even to get close to answering that one. Let's go to Rob, first-time caller, truck driving in Ohio. Rob, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, Stephen. Nice to talk to you guys.
You too, Rob.
I just wanted to get your opinion. I've talked to a lot of my friends about this. Stephen, I was just wondering what you thought of the theory of aliens messing with DNA over and over and over until they got to where we're at today, and they finally got us as humans the way we are, and with all these black-eyed children and all that, if they're continuing to mess with DNA, and thinking that, you know, like we pray to God and he supposedly hears us. Well, aliens, you know, mental telepathy and all that. Just wondering what you thought about if aliens do exist, if that's maybe what happened, that they finally got to where we're at today.
Well, I'm just not familiar with any evidence that aliens interfering with our DNA. There have been some interesting articles written about using DNA or the genetic code as a kind of an interstellar signaling, or that our DNA may even hold some kind of evidence of that. But I don't think the evidence, at least what I've seen, is very convincing about that, and that you know, evolution by natural selection, Darwinian natural selection, by, you know, the usual method, probably accounts for most of what we know about life on Earth now.
Stephen, there are some that believe that there's an extra planet in the solar system, a planet X, that is on a very big elliptical orbit. As a scientist, I mean, have you looked into that possibility, or what do you think of that theory?
Well, of course, yes, that used to be called the 10th planet, and we've gone the
That's
other direction.
Right.
I was involved in the demotion of Pluto, so we're now down to 8 planets.
You did that. The astrologers will get you for that one.
I was at the meeting that was in Prague in 2006 when the vote was there to demote Pluto. But in terms of, and there used to be, what Planet X used to mean was a 10th planet that would account for the gravitational perturbations on Uranus and Neptune that Pluto, it turned out, was too small to cause. And they never found those. They never found another 10th planet. And it turns out that once they adjusted for the mass of Uranus and Neptune, that there was no need for a 10th planet. Now, this other planet that you described, I think there's still some discussion about that, but it'd be very hard to... I think it would be in a position that you couldn't observe it. So I don't know how you would ever be able to prove that.
Let's go next to Sean in Spokane, Washington. Sean, you're up with us. Go ahead. Go ahead, Sean. Well, how about Tom in Seattle? Go ahead, Tom.
Hello, George. Hey. I'm a retired Boeing experimental flight test mechanic and home-built airplane builder, and I had 58 contacts over 20 years with one of the 16 alien gray races that are prowling around out there. And I picked up some of their attitudes, and I want to ask you some questions with regard to some of the things I've learned. First of all, their whole technology is based on gravity compression. This ranges all the way down to pencil thin waves for interstellar communication. And the gravity inside this is so intense, time and space does not exist, and they modulate that for communication. They enlarge that for interstellar propulsion. And then they micro-miniaturize it for invisibility cloaks around the clothing in their bodies. Okay. The next thing I would comment on is they have electronic beings, okay? They have created electronic beings that they broadcast into electronic conductors, okay? And they consider Earth to be a zoo planet. Now, the aliens have put these beings in Russian and American missile silos to keep the baboons from blowing up the zoo. Okay, now the next thing I asked them about is, what do you know about God? And they said God is a race of semi-eternal beings who roam the galaxy, seeding life for their own entertainment. Okay, now if you sit and think about this, this fits in with all religions and all the science we've covered up to date so far because of our DNA and these amino acids floating around out there. Now, George, if I might have 3 seconds for a plug. This is all documented in my DVD book set on eBay called Aliens in My Toy Shop. Now, I'll wait off the air for your comments.
All right. Well, first and foremost, Stephen, who knows, huh?
Well, I think you've gone beyond my expertise there. I think there's some great ideas there for science fiction, but... who knows exactly? How do you prove some of those things?
The God factor, again, is something when, and let me ask you this, and if I'm getting too close to your little boy lifestyle, let me know, but were you raised with religion? I'm curious to see when scientists develop. I just wonder if they were raised with religion or not.
Yes, I was raised Catholic. In fact, I have a sister.
Me too.
So... I was raised that way. I'm now what I would describe as a religious naturalist. In other words, I don't think we need supernaturalism, but that there's plenty of spirituality and awe and wonder in the natural world. So that's where I stand now.
Was there a point where you stopped believing in a divine creator?
There must have been. Yeah, only in my career after college, I would say.
Something, yeah, that's an interesting take. Okay, well, stay with us. We're going to come back for final phone call, Stephen, in just a moment. So those of you on hold, I will get right to you. Those of you who can get through, give it a try. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Catherine Albrecht joins us. It'll be a split show, but she'll be one of those special guests. Make sure you join us as we talk about the sign of the beast, the Antichrist, and other privacy issues as well. And when we come back with Stephen Dick, we'll wrap things up with final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Final phone calls here with Stephen Dick. Stephen, I wanted to thank you, by the way, for going the full distance with us on the program. Appreciate it.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Let us go back to the calls. Now, Keith is in San Mateo, California. Keith, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Stephen. I have three quick comments and a question, and I'd like to have the opportunity to respond to the answer to that question, if possible.
All right, sure.
Thank you. My first question or first comment was Stephen made the comment he didn't know why the West seemed obsessed, for lack of a better word, with UFOs, why the East did not. And I think I have an answer to that. I think it's because the West's theology traditionally has been condemnatory, where the East has not. So people have in the West have a subconscious need to prove that there is something else out there, and perhaps prove theology wrong, because again, the Western world has traditionally been believe this way or you're sizzling for eternity, where Buddhism or Hinduism hasn't taken such a stance, so there's not that innate subconscious drive to prove the system wrong. Second of all, I'd like to make the comment during, you know, we're talking about all this outer space stuff, which is fascinating, but let's not forget that inner space is just as vast as outer space. And, you know, you think about that for a while, that'll get your head spinning. Third, while we're talking about inner space on that quantum level, Stephen, you made the comment that, you know, with the new telescopes and stuff, they found what they expected to find that coincided with the Big Bang Theory. And I'm just putting it out there that perhaps they found, quote-unquote, evidence that supported the Big Bang Theory because that's what they were looking for. And again, that goes to a quantum physics level. And then fourth, my question is, and I'll proceed it with a quick comment, I find some scientists, just like some religious people, where they use God as the cop-out, or, well, just because they say, well, it is just what it is, I find some scientists doing that too. And I thought, and I mean this, I'm saying this out of respect, you perhaps did that too, and I'd like to put you on the spot in a very respectful way, Stephen. George had asked you regarding the Big Bang. He says, okay, it's the universe is expanding, and what is it expanding into? And he kind of gave an example with the balloon, but then you just kind of brushed over and said, well, it's just kind of the way it is. Well, scientifically, if you have expansion, it has to have a space to expand into. So what, I want an answer. What's it expanding into?
All right. I don't know if we can get that answer, but you want to take another stab at it, Stephen?
Well, I'm not a cosmologist, so I'm not the expert on this. But, when I talk to people about this, they tell me it's not the right question to ask. It's space and time expanding together, and it doesn't necessarily need to expand into anything. Now that's counterintuitive, but that's the answer that I get when I ask this question. And about with regard to the Big Bang, some people are still skeptical of the Big Bang, and of course, this being science, we do need to say that we're not 100% sure about the Big Bang theory. We always have to leave, 1% or something open to another theory, in the same way that Newtonian physics was eventually succeeded or at least supplemented by relativity. If you would say, if you'd argue that the Big Bang was true 100%, it'd be the same thing as religion. In science, we always have to leave open the possibility that there's something better beyond the current theories that we hold.
Okay, Keith, thanks for that. Let's take some more calls before we call it a night. Swansea, Missouri, Sarah's a first-time caller. Hey, Sarah, good morning.
Oh, hi, George. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is so exciting. And Stephen, I really wanted to ask a question I've had in my mind a long time, and I was wondering about Mars. I can understand us going to Mars for exploration purposes, but I really don't understand why everyone keeps talking about colonization and terraforming, of all things, when there's no radiation shield on Mars.
Right. Well, terraforming, of course, would be very controversial. I think this goes to a question that's always debated within NASA and outside of NASA. Do we need human spaceflight at all? Why can't we just go with robotic spaceflight? Because human spaceflight is so much more expensive. I think we need both, that they are complementary and that humans do need to explore. It's just part of in fact, I would say that NASA is the prime agency in the United States for exploration. Now, colonization is another thing. Certainly, there's no question of moving vast numbers of people to Mars for colonization. So what you would be talking about would be a small group of people that could eventually become self-sufficient. And for that, I would argue that that is not such a bad idea, because we just don't know what's going to happen to the Earth. We have these near-Earth asteroids that are shooting around us, so we're like a target practice here. And occasionally you'll see this in a significant way, as we did in Chelyabinsk in Russia a few years ago, when windows were shattered when that giant fireball came by.
That's right.
And if it had been a little bit bigger, you know, it could have had a lot more destructive potential.
Oh, my God. 1,400 people were injured, as it was, right?
Yeah. And there are much bigger ones out there, which NASA is trying to catalog, but they haven't cataloged all of them yet. So the point is, to your question, that it would not hurt for some human beings to be off of the planet, so that if, you know, there was a massive destruction, that we wouldn't have to start over from scratch after 3.8 billion years of the evolution of life. That's about when we think, you know, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. By 3.8 billion years, we had primitive life, and it took 3.8 billion years to arrive at us. So if you have people off of the planet, and the planet is severely compromised, then at least you wouldn't have to reinvent human beings. So I think that's one reason to have human space exploration and colonization.
Stephen, I don't seem to get excited if they talk about microbial life. I want intelligent life out there. That's what I want to hear about. But science would still go crazy if they discovered microbial life, wouldn't they?
Oh, I think so, because in part because it would, as we talked about before, you know, give us some insights into universal biology. What is universal about biology, and what is particular to us? But beyond that, I think microbial life, you know, a second genesis, an independent genesis, and by that I mean not life that came from Earth. For example, if we find microbes on Mars and it turns out they were just seeded there from the Earth, that's one thing. But if it's an independent genesis, and you had life, even microbial life, evolve on two planets so close together, that means that life will originate pretty easily. And that has implications in for the rest of the universe. And as we saw on Earth, it takes a while. It takes a few billion years. But once you have microbial life, you might have intelligent life. So the crucial thing is to find that second genesis, that second independent genesis, which will tell us a lot about how easy it is to originate life. And we don't know the answer to that question now, because we don't even know how life exactly originated on the Earth. So that, I think microbial life would have a big effect. And we saw also, you know, with, as we talked about the Mars rock, that was just a possibility of a fossil, and people got all excited about that, although it was a short-term impact. But if it turned out to be real, then I think it would have had even more of an impact.
Let's go to John in Sewell, New Jersey now. It's your turn, John. Go ahead, sir.
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Real quick, going back to your rotation of the galaxies, Doctor, and the anomalies that regular physics can't explain, that they throw dark matter in to explain it. I've always felt that dark matter is kind of a misnomer, or even a cop-out. Because I believe in the association that things are, well, let's put it this way. You know how in Newtonian physics, can't explain everything when speed go up to a speed of light, whereas
right.
Einsteinian physics can't explain it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the rotation of the galaxies can be explained more so in like a higher dimensions, whereas with gravity extending into higher dimensions, like string theory explains with M theory, I think it's called. Just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm not really up on string theory. That's not my thing. And it would depend on the mathematics, I think. The mathematics in terms of the galaxies and dark matter being the cause for the rotation of the galaxies in an anomalous kind of a way I think accounts for that, whereas I just can't, you'd have to prove with mathematics this thing about the higher dimensions, the M theory and string theory.
Stephen, for some budding young guy who wants to go through school and be a scientist or a woman, do you recommend this field?
Astrobiology?
Yes.
Yes, of course. It's a field that, you need to know a lot about a lot of different things. And I think that's the way, this multidisciplinarity is the way science is going. Not only about chemistry and the physics and astronomy, mm-hmm. but also about biology. So I think you see this in the young people coming into the field. Only maybe 20 or 30 years ago, still, exobiology, which is the old name for astrobiology, was still called a science without a subject. But there certainly is a subject now with the discovery of all these exoplanets and all the work that's being done in the laboratory on the origin of life. So I think the original statement about exobiology being a science without a subject was really a misconception about what science is all about. After all, the search for gravity waves or even the search for the planets beyond our solar system, that was a science without a subject for a while. So it's without a subject until you find what you're looking for. It's called exploration. So astrobiology is really an exploration based on the preconceptions that we talked about earlier, the Copernican and the Darwinian ideas that wherever life can arise, it will arise. And I think that really is a not only an incentive for people coming into the field, but also a real exciting subject for teaching and in education. You find that young people, whenever you go in to talk in classes, they're real excited about this subject.
Let's go to Angel in Louisiana now. Angel, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Angel Rodriguez. I'm calling in regard to an incident that I was on 4th of July in Tampa Bay. We were going across the Courtney Campbell Causeway.
Yeah.
And at around 11 o'clock in broad daylight, the traffic was so backed up, everybody going to Clearwater and all the islands where the all the barbecue pits, everybody was enjoying the 4th of July beautiful day. And in broad daylight, the traffic stopped. Everybody started looking towards the Sunshine Skyway Bridge in that direction. And a object almost, I can't give you a fathom the size, but it covered the whole sky when it went over the top of us. And you probably could only see about maybe 20% from the horizon to the ceiling.
Wow.
And I just can't believe I've gone on the internet trying to find other people that have seen it. I mean, it was me, my mother, my father, my two sisters, and some friends in a station wagon. We all got outside. And I'll never forget the sound that it made when it went over the top of us. It was so loud that I could scream at you and you would not be able to hear it. And the sound was like this. Wah, 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 wah. It was just un-freaking real.
Well, let me ask you this, Stephen, as we talk about extraterrestrials and ETs, this could be our technology too, right?
Well, you mean in terms of an Air Force project or something like that?
Yeah, some kind of black ops program.
Well, it could be. I mean, they are, there are secret programs out there, which by definition we don't know anything about. But to cause something like that, I think, they would probably not try to show themselves by making such a spectacle as that. So it's always interesting, I think, when you have descriptions like this, and if you have more than one observer, other people must have seen the same thing, and we see how different the accounts can be when multiple observers see the same thing. You see that every day. You see it, for example, in the Michael Brown case out in Ferguson, where a dozen witnesses
I'm right
have a dozen
here
different accounts.
Yep, Absolutely.
So, you know, observers, especially under certain conditions, you know, of stress and that sort of thing, can see very, very different things. And that's why the whole debate over UFOs and the evidence is so difficult, I think.
Yeah, well, it really is. So, Stephen, we're almost out of time. Give everybody your websites, if you would, and the name of your titles.
The titles of the two books that I'm coming out with, one is The Impact of Discovering Life Beyond Earth, and the other one is Cosmic Encounters, How Discovering Life Beyond Earth Will Transform Our Thinking. Those will be out next year, and you can go to my website at stephenjdick.com, I believe it is, or you can just Google that and find all my other titles, including the books related to what we've been talking about today, Life on Other Worlds and the Biological Universe.
It's been great talking to you. And I don't know what took you so long to get on our show. You should have been on years ago with us.
I don't know. I've been busy writing books.
Okay, well, you keep in touch with us, okay?
Okay. Thanks very much, and good talking with you.
Stephen Dick, a great astrophysicist, talking about things out there in space. And he's kind of open-minded to the possibility of ET life, and I think that's refreshing. It really is. Well, make sure you're part of our program tomorrow with Catherine Albrecht as we talk about the sign of the beast and also some incredible privacy issues here on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.